Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The people who are on this panel today are whose CVs you can find in the little brochure and whose text you can also find on the IGS website. All have very distinguished careers, and they represent an extraordinary source of knowledge as well as experience. I would say in electoral analysis, in electoral behavior, in Canada-U.S. relations, in the place of multiculturalism, the sense of identity, and actually what really unites these four persons is the fact that they know a lot about the other country, independently of where they work. Jack Citrin, you've already encountered at the beginning of, so I don't have too much to say about Jack's posting and present direction of the Institute here at Berkeley. Except to say that as well as Richard Johnston and Henry Brady, he's a specialist in quantitative analysis, but he will endeavor, and they will endeavor today, to talk about qualitative aspects of behavioral aspects of the electorates in both countries and both societies, actually. Colin Robertson, for himself, has always had a step foot in academia and diplomacy and business and observation. He's one of Canada's foremost American watchers, I would say, with a prolific amount of information in newsletters and observation of think tanks in the United States in the past many years. He's now with McKenna Long, a K Street lawyers firm in Washington. I'm not sure that's a good thing. it is for them. Our panelists will have 20 to 25 minutes to address the issues found in their paper, which are about sensitivities, values, behaviors, and what makes identity around the themes of the perception of self in the U.S. and Canada, the perception of the other in U.S. and Canada, immigration issues and how these affect both of the previous, and of course the role of the state and how it's perceived and lived in both countries. The challenge at the end of their 20-minute presentation will be for Henry Brady and Colin Robertson to, in 5 minutes, and I will tolerate 6 and 20 seconds each, to try to see how all of that, which is going to be very descriptive and very interesting, inform or has the capacity to inform decision-making, policy-making, diplomacy, the crafting of agendas, the crafting of cooperation, which is actually what these endeavors are about. And I think they can say so with some honest modesty. The kind of endeavors you have here can influence policymakers, because ultimately policymakers accept to be partly influenced by other than pure electoral issues, including thought. And this is what it's about. So I'll leave it to our two main presenters. And gentlemen, you have 20 minutes and 35 seconds.
Okay. Well, thank you, dear Mark. And Richard and I did this collaboratively. It was a wonderful collaboration for me, particularly at 11:30 last night when we were sitting at the dining room of my home and Richard was creating this magnificent PowerPoint presentation watched over by someone who's still trying to learn how to retrieve email. So Richard is the man behind this, but it was a wonderful collaboration. And, you know, this panel, after listening to the first panel, this is sort of like the descent from the sublime world of high politics to the mundane, grubby world of what ordinary people in the street say or don't say. So let me quickly lay out sort of the questions that we're going to address, and then we'll turn to the data. I think it's fair to say that for every national self, there is a designated other. We define ourselves in contradistinction to others, and the United States has often defined itself as not Europe, and Canada tends to define itself, or some might argue, as not the United States. Yet if you look at things a little more deeply, there's enormous evidence of similarity and even convergence between the two countries in terms of their history, culture, institutional structures, language to some extent. And we ask the question, what about values? And what about values and identities in the context of something which several of you have pointed out to me in the coffee hour earlier, is the context of tremendous demographic change in both countries, which in terms of the religious and ethnic composition of both societies have in the last 30 years been undergoing tremendous change. So in a way, an intriguing question is posed. If Europe can creep towards political integration in the face of enormous cultural differences, can North America, Canada, and the United States, with their much greater level of cultural similarity, move towards some kind of common integration in policy or even institutions? And that's sort of the question that we pose. It's not so different from the question posed earlier. Alan Gottlieb and Thomas Pickering talked about some of the impediments, strategic, and in terms of the different level of attention to these problems in the two countries at the highest level, we ask a somewhat separate question. Is there anything in the political cultures of the two countries that might push towards cooperation or towards separation and conflict? And how do we go about that? So we are, as Pierre Marc said, survey researchers. We mine over public opinion surveys, of which there are a huge number, and we've overlooked many. I was chagrined to learn that Bob Pastor has written two books, which we should have read and cited, and maybe then we would have a different paper. So, you know, take it easy on us, Bob, when it comes your turn. But we made a particular decision, which was to look at recent surveys in which identical questions were asked to national samples of the two countries. And so we focused on the 2003 and 2006 International Social Survey program, which is run out of NORC, University of Chicago, and, you know, survey factories in the different countries. So what this means is we have a snapshot in time, and it's a limited snapshot, and we don't comment in any detail on trends at all, which is maybe a weakness. Okay. I'll come to this in a minute. In the academic literature, the discussion of political culture of Canada and the United States, there are two main slogans. One is American exceptionalism, and related to that, the idea of a continental divide. The seminal statement of this argument is by Seymour Martin Lipset, who argued the American Revolution resulted in two distinct cultural trajectories: the Whig and libertarian American culture, emphasizing distrust of the state, individualism, egalitarianism, and populism, and the Tory Canadian culture, which was more accepting of the need for a strong state, respect for political authority. Okay? And so these are sort of two mirror images, sort of animated much of the historical literature on the two countries. There's, of course, a very important subtext, sub-theme in the discussion of Canada, which is the degree of division between French Canada and Quebec and English Canada. Lipset addresses this, but not in a very systematic way. So, what we thought we would do was to take a look at the historical accuracy and empirical validity of these sort of capsule distinctions between Canada and the United States, and focusing on, this is a very sort of political science-y, jargonish definition of political culture. It's political culture is a patterned way of thinking about political life that is widely shared, spans the generations, excludes other values and customs. And what this is maybe more important, that political culture is viewed as constraining what actions government can do, what projects are feasible, what would be accepted, and what are legitimate. So we don't view public opinion as essentially directing public policy, but in some sense constraining in a permissive way what projects a democratic polity will do. Okay, and so in looking at this, the slides to follow, and I'm going to turn this over to Richard momentarily, do two things. First of all, we focus really on five themes. We have five actually up there now, I think. Didn't edit that at 12:30 at night, Richard. Patriotism and national attachment, definitions, how Canadians and Americans define their own countries, define their own fellow citizens. Then opinions about immigration and multiculturalism, obviously a very important issue in both societies, which has implications for how the countries redefine themselves. Then looking at the argument that essentially Americans are more anti-statist, anti-government than Canada, and if that is true, that could have implications for the kinds of cooperation, the kinds of mechanisms for cooperation in policy domains, what role for the state, what role for the market. And then finally, we dug up from the Pew National Polls of 2009, there's questions about how do Americans think of Canadians, how favorably do Americans view Canadians, and vice versa. So we will close on that note of mutual admiration or something less than admiration. We shall see. Okay. So this is what we're going to do. We've made a presentation that in some ways emphasizes, I think, the differences. It might be said to sort of tease out differences from a body of data in which actually, and this is, I think, what Bob Pastor said to me earlier, there is evidence of convergence and similarity that is quite strong. And so I'm going to let Richard walk through this, and then we will hope that both the discussants and the audience will move from our descriptive presentation to asking questions and making comments about the implications.
Thanks, Jack. So as Jack mentioned, part of the object was to get absolutely identical questions from start to finish to Canadian American national samples. And for this, the ISSP is actually particularly good, because what the ISSP does, it's a kind of an ongoing multi-decade collaboration amongst survey facilities in about 40 or so countries. Unfortunately, Mexico is not one of these. What they would do basically is adopt a theme for a given round and explore the theme in depth and then come back to this theme a decade or so later. So the 2003 ISSP in particular emphasizes national identity. 2006 emphasizes questions of the welfare state. We really wish that they had actually linked the two, because there's a whole controversy in the world about the relationship between national solidarity on one hand and support for welfare state spending on the other, but they're not linked. So we have to do them in parallel here. The other thing I'll mention is that you won't see much in the way of regional content. We actually started out thinking in terms that there might actually be so much regional variation within each country that this would help frame and put in context the differences between the countries such as they were. We somehow imagined that what we were really going to see was the coasts, the great center of the continent, and the south, stuck in the 17th century, and that in some ways this would be the story of North American policy. But in fact, as it turns out, for the most part, we were more struck by, where there were differences, the trans-border difference, the relatively weak differences within. To the extent that that's not true, it lies in the place where you might expect it to be, namely in the French-English division within Canada. Although even there, it's quite striking that many of the differences are small and occasionally in an opposite direction from what you expect. The take-home, just to anticipate, is that there's, at least to the extent that you emphasize on the differences, there's no getting around the fact that the U.S. is a more solidary place. It's not a binational kind of setup in any sense. But also when you get into the substance of what you might be proud of, for example, there are just more things that Americans can come up with, though the military is particularly important here. At the same time as being more solidary, it's clearly more exclusive, and this is actually a bit of a shocker, considering the kind of, at least ostensibly, culturally neutral constitutional self-definition of the place. So there is, it's a more exclusive place. The things that Americans affirm as essential to being an American include more things that you simply cannot acquire, that you have them or you don't, and that's actually kind of striking. Bigger fear of immigration and immigrants in this country. We suspect that that's not so much a cultural code as it has to do with the structure of immigration in the two countries as it differs across the border, but we actually don't have any direct evidence on that. On the other hand, again, somewhat to our surprise, though more fearful of immigrants and immigration, Americans are actually more indulgent. We have a set of questions that go to the essence of multicultural policy, not using that word, but nonetheless to do with assimilation versus kind of indulgence of group differences. And Americans are actually more indulgent in this respect than Canadians. Some of this has to do with French Canada in particular, but it isn't just a matter of French and English. Canadians, non-surprisingly, are on balance more supportive of government intervention. The differences aren't great, and when you actually look at the pattern, you suspect that it is a result not so much of some kind of ingrained DNA as it is experience with the state, with the program. We actually do stuff in the realm of redistribution and health care, which leads us to conclude that these things are possible. In this country, they remain largely hypotheses. So that's and then the final point is that, as Garrison Keillor once said, Garrison Keillor, ancestrally from Cumberland County, Nova Scotia, the family is, once said that Canadians are the people that you mothers want to take their daughters to the prom. That still seems to be true in the general pattern of mutual regard, that there is still a terrific amount of goodwill there. So onto some pictures before I run out of time. So basic convention here. Well, this is a very crude form of something called a dot plot. And what I've done is I've linked the dots to kind of draw your attention to the comparisons I want you to make. And you know, the bottom ones are Americans, the top ones are Canadians. Typically, what you'll see is all native immigrant in both countries, and then there's a Quebec francophone, rest of Canada in the Canadian one. Not all of them have the French English distinction, but most do. Basically, to the right is more. Either more proud, feel closer, more supportive, stronger feeling, whatever is the label on the graph, to the right is more of that. So this is just pride and attachment, and the take-home is on the left here. In the abstract, the countries are, if you ask people how proud they are, everybody's proud. Francophone Quebecois, not so proud, not so close to the country as a whole as the rest of Canada. That's not a surprise. But the general pattern is that if you ask people in the abstract, are they proud of who they are? Do they feel close to who they are? In general, Yeah, they are. But it's a pretty dippy question, as a matter of fact, and it makes more sense to get into specifics. So another way of going at this is to ask, well, how proud are these various things? So there's 10 items up there about which you might be variously proud or not, as the case may be. And once you start to get into that, in both countries, what you see is that you get a more nuanced picture. And one sense, it looks as if the two countries just simply slide to the less proud end of the distribution when you get into specifics, with maybe Canadians moving a little bit further away from the generalized pride. But part of what's going on there is actually that you see that there's actually considerable difference object by object in what makes people proud. And the thing that Canadians peculiarly value more than Americans do is the welfare state, basically. It's the country's system of social security, as the questionnaire puts it. Now, it's not that Canadians are so much prouder of the welfare state than they are of other aspects of Canada. If you sort of look with if you look at the top point up here, it's one of the things about which Canadians are actually rather proud and Americans not so proud. The big contrast, and maybe this won't surprise you, is that Americans are much more proud of their armed forces than Canadians are of theirs. Now, this was 2003. The gap may have narrowed. Who knows? Given the Canadian involvement in Afghanistan and the combat death toll, which now sits at 140. But this is an enormous gap, and it is the widest gap in the whole field. So there's a hint of both an aspect of solidarity and a bit of the meaning of it. If you go on to ask whether this cashes out in chauvinism, so here's the question. People should support their country even if the country is in the wrong. Right? This is a place where the rubber hits the road, I suppose you could say. The first thing that hits you, so that's those are the black dots on the left there. I mean, there's a kind of crude correspondence between pride in the armed forces and willingness to say this, but not a trivial, it would seem, Canada-U.S. difference in the willingness to say that you should support the country even if wrong. Now, note where the picture puts America and Canada. It's not as if there's some sort of unanimous position on this side of the border that America should be supported even if it's wrong. This is a question on which there's a lot of disagreement. It's sitting there at 0.5. The way we've coded it, that means basically there's almost exactly even agreement and disagreement. But it is displaced rather more to the chauvinist side than Canadian opinion is. So I'll just leave it at that. There's a bit more of a tinge of chauvinism in here, in the U.S. What does it mean to be an American or Canadian? So here the question is basically, it's a battery. Here's some things that might make you a real American, a real Canadian. How important is it that you have the characteristic in order to qualify as a real American or qualify as a real Canadian? Well, there's a kind of a bunch of points in this picture. First of all, if you look at the green dots, okay, those are that's an index of achievable characteristics. You ought to become a citizen. You ought to learn one of the official language or languages. You ought to feel like you belong. You should respect the laws and institutions, right? Those are achievable characteristics. They're a kind of civic content to identity. And in both Canada and the U.S., there's a willingness to impose civic but achievable tests. In both countries, when you move over to characteristics that are more ascribed, so the extreme is have ancestors in the country, be born in the country, have lived in the country for a long time, be a Christian. There, summarily, Canadians and Americans are less likely to impose those tests than they are achievable characteristic tests, but Americans are more likely to impose those tests than Canadians are, and the difference is Americans are more likely to impose the test, although notice that there's a very striking immigrant native-born difference within the American sample on this question. There is a pretty striking difference within the Canadian sample on the ascribed characteristics question as well, although in the sense that immigrants are much less likely to impose ascription characteristics than natives are in Canada. But I'd also want you to look at the Christian line. It's kind of an interesting irony. Francophone Quebecois are the least likely of in this setup to impose Christianity as a test. The irony, of course, is that secularism has become a trope in the debate inside Quebec, and the issue isn't really Christians as so much as Muslims, but I think we can come back to that. There's just a general point that there's a kind of more exclusive tone to what is affirmed as an American identity, even as there is a more solidary character to the nationality. Attitudes to immigration. We suspect these are as much consequence as cause of immigration patterns, but there is no denying the basic pattern, which is that when you ask whether the number of immigrants should be more, fewer, or about the same, Americans are much more likely than Canadians to say fewer. Canadian opinion on this question is now almost perfectly balanced. Not surprisingly, immigrant Canadians are more supportive of immigration than native-born Canadians, but group by group, the general pattern is greater support in Canada. That includes even comparisons between Canadian immigrants or immigrants to Canada and immigrants to the U.S. Similarly, if you ask about the consequences of immigration, two of these questions are positive, two of them are negatives. We've framed it as fear, but in fact, one of the questions asked is immigration is good for the economy. On the other hand, immigration steals jobs. So there's four questions cast as fear. There's greater sense of fear of the consequences in this country, though again, in both countries, newcomers are less fearful than the native-born, not surprisingly. On the other hand, in both countries, there's considerable skepticism about the content of multiculturalism. What strikes us, however, is that the skepticism is particularly sharp on the Canadian side of the border. It's generally true that the most skeptical, in particular, the expectation that immigrants should adapt to the mores of the host country, unsurprisingly, most strongly felt amongst Quebec Francophones. But if you look at the rest of the country, including immigrants to Canada, in general, there's a more assimilationist distribution of opinion than in the U.S., notwithstanding the elaborate suite of multicultural programs, perhaps because of the more elaborate suite of multicultural programs in Canada. In any case, summarily, in neither country is there exactly a groundswell of demand for multiculturalism? This is the basic point about government intervention. So here, basically, it's the Canada-U.S. difference. To the right means that Canada is more supportive of information of intervention, to the left, less. The number of issue areas in which Canadians are more supportive than Americans is slightly larger than the reverse, but note that there are a set of issue areas in which the reverse is true. When you focus on two particular things, healthcare and reduction in income differences, this actually strikes us as pretty significant, though again, we're skeptical that this is something fundamentally cultural, notwithstanding the way Jack set it up at the beginning, but that in fact this probably reflects experience with policy, a quite a bit more redistributive tax and transfer system, and, of course, a public healthcare system. And then national images of the other. This is the final slide with pictures. This is the Pew question about your overall opinion of Canadians and Americans, asked of both Canadians and Americans. Jack and I see the take home here as that basically both sides still have a considerable reservoir of goodwill for the others, even to the extent that Americans claim to have almost as favorable a view of Canadians as they do of other Americans. One might speculate why that is so, but anyway. This was done, by the way, in June of 2009. So this is post Obama election. Might have been different a year earlier. I don't know. So here's that's the take home, which I basically started with. Americans do seem more solidary than Canadians, less divided on who they are, prouder of their achievements, more willing to project power. American identity is more exclusive, more defined by traits that are difficult or impossible for newcomers to acquire. Though differences in the policies at the core of the welfare state are modest, Americans are less interventionist than Canadians. No surprise. These differences, notwithstanding, the two populations hold each other in high regard, and our exit is how do these similarities shape the trajectory? And at that point, we quit. It's over to you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. You're starting first? Very good. Mr. Brady?
Well, this is I'm commenting on work done by two of my teachers. Jack Citrin has been my colleague for 20 years, and I've learned an enormous amount about identity and multiculturalism and a whole lot of topics like that. And Richard Johnston taught me everything I know about Canada. So if I make any mistakes, it's Richard's fault. By the way, Richard also brought some of his former graduate students, so this makes me a little nervous. The posse is out there watching everything I do. I want to talk about two themes. First, I want to relate findings to social structural census, that kind of data, and the history of Canada and the United States, and then end with why do we care, which was the way this presentation ended as well. Let's just start with some basic statistics and information, which everybody knows, about Canada versus the United States. In Canada, we have 25% approximately people whose mother tongue is French. That's a big difference between the United States and Canada, where we have no such number with respect to another language. Because a lot of those francophones are concentrated in Quebec, we have, not surprisingly, the finding that pride in Canada is less in Quebec than the rest of Canada. We also see a greater emphasis on assimilation in Quebec, no doubt especially because the presumption or desire is that people who come to Quebec need to learn the language, and that's very, very important. Minorities, visible minorities. In Canada, it's about 13%. In the United States, it's about 25%, about double, a lot bigger group. And that's African Americans and Hispanics mainly. So it's maybe surprising that in both places there's still a tremendous emphasis on achievable characteristics. I think it says something about both countries that they're not focused, as some countries would be given those statistics on visible minorities, especially in the United States, on the ascriptive characteristics. They're focused on achievable characteristics as a way to become Canadian or become American. We have essentially then in both countries the French model of citizenship. You can become French by learning the language and becoming like the rest of the French people. It's not the German notion where it's ancestry and the color of your skin and things like that. This is not surprising, that in the U.S. with a larger fraction of visible minorities, there's a concern with immigrants, much more than we get in Canada. So that's not a surprise. There's also religious differences between the two countries. In both places have about the same fraction percentage of people who are Christians, identify themselves as such. But in Canada, the largest group is Roman Catholics, about 40% of the total population, whereas in the United States, it's Protestants at about 50%. Furthermore, a lot larger subgroup of the Protestant population in the United States, percentage-wise and in terms of obviously absolute numbers, is fundamentalist, evangelical, and so forth. So that, for example, if you ask a question in the United States and Canada of the importance of converting people to Christianity, the classic evangelical question, how important is it to convert people to Christianity? About 10% of Canadians say that's important, and about 40% of Americans say that's important. That, by the way, has got very good congruence with the statistic that we see in this paper of 49% of the people in the U.S. say it's important to be a Christian to be a member of the community.
Very important.
Right, and very important, and 22% in Canada. So obviously the presence or absence of evangelical Christianity is very important in terms of not just religious practice, but in terms of inclusion within and the characteristics which include you within the political community. And so that's an important thing to know. Also, perhaps because there's more other religions in Canada, about double the percentage, and there's a lot more Hindu, Sikh, Muslim in Canada percentage-wise than the United States, as a result, Canadians seem to be more tolerant and more willing to say that it's not important to be a Christian, to become a member of the political community. Also, just historically, it's well to remember that in Canada, there's remnants of the social gospel in a party up there, the NDP. There's nothing like that in the United States. there's sort of remnants of, I guess, fundamentalism and through social credit in that very zigzag way that that gets through reform and then finally gets to the current Conservative Party. But it's a rather tortured line of dissent. In the United States, of course, in the Republican Party right now, fundamentalists and evangelicals are a very important part of the party. Now, Stephen Harper is the Prime Minister of Canada, so we can debate whether how important that is or is not. But what's been remarkable about Harper is he hasn't really exhibited much of his Christian beliefs in a lot of his policy approaches. So to survive, he has really not talked a lot about that. Okay. And then finally, it's not a surprise maybe that we see more support for the welfare state in Canada and that they're proud of it. That may be this descent of social gospel through NDP and so forth, perhaps also the Tory tradition that Lipset and others talk about. So let me just end with, why do we care? Well, we may care just to have understanding of Canada, and I hope and I think this paper does provide us with some of that. It's also maybe that we'll get along if we're more similar. That's typically true. And there's certainly lots of commonality. In fact, what would be interesting is take the ISPP data for other countries and show how similar we are compared to other countries. And my guess is we're quite similar compared to a lot of other countries. But then finally, is there really the notion that we'd have a North American Union like the European Union? I don't think so, given these data. It seems to me there are substantial differences. And furthermore, I just think there's a lot of political obstacles to such a thing. But others who know more about that should talk about it than me. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Henry. Colin?
Myth, reality, and contradictions matter to both national narratives. We put much more emphasis on not being American. It's the genuflectual reaction of most Canadians when asked what they are when we be abroad than being overtly Canadian. Yet the rest of the world tells us in many ways we are similar. And indeed, when you think of something like football and tailgate parties, we know what these things are, although there is a variation. The Canadian football field's a little longer, and we have a slightly different football. So we're similar, but we're not the same. We are born out of your prolonged birth pangs, first when you cut the umbilical cord, and we stayed attached and became not yourselves, but who we are. When the Civil War reforged the Union, the Canadian Confederation was obliged to stretch from sea to sea or face immersion in American expansion. Once again, we remained ourselves. Canadianness has often been a matter of contingency, not one of certainty, as we wrestled and compromised and continue to do so with geography and climate. One of the comments you made about Canadians and their armed forces, we may not be a warrior nation, but when called upon, we can be a nation of warriors, and arguably the next major step after the Civil War in terms of Canadian identity was born on the battlefields of Vimy Ridge. For the most part, we welcome waves of immigrants in part as a defense against you, and we've made a virtue of it. We make a virtue of a mosaic and a multiculturalism. We accept the role of government as guardians of the social contract. Early in November, I was in Washington and up at one of the tea parties, and I couldn't help reflect that it's not sort of thing we'd see in Canada. We would buy the Oliver Wendell Holmes argument that civilized taxes are the price of civilization. Canadians are much more inclined to accept that's what's necessary. There is really no other choice. There always has been an ambiguity about what Americans would call shared history and less exuberance to nationality and fits of nationalism, notwithstanding what you'll see in Olympic hockey, for example. Canada has always been a deal based on choice rather than the universal idea made manifest, and thus the eternal question about identity. The irony is that the rest of the world knows who we are and what we stand for, even if we're not so sure about it ourselves. So I think the problem is not the brand abroad, but more the brand at home. Quebec and the French fact are a constant theme in our identity, and yet Quebec is the cornerstone of our diversity, and I think here you point that out a bit, and the challenge to national homogeneity and the melting pot. And the French fact, it's also worth pointing out, is national, even if we sometimes forget it. Jean Sauvé, born in Saskatchewan, Gabrielle Roy, born in the hometown of, born in Manitoba, the province of Ellen and myself, and of course, Michel Jean, our Governor General, who comes from Haiti. We continue, like the United States, to be under construction with all the tugs and pulls that migration brings. Unlike the rest of the world, it's not a racial-based national narrative for us. Since 1980, and this is important to underline, more than half of new Canadians come from Asia, and with relatively little controversy. You go to our big cities, you think, go from Montreal to Toronto, to Calgary, to Vancouver, and I've been just about the Olympics, you're constantly aware of this, and yet it happens with very little difficulty. If the West is the American frontier, for us, of course, it is the North, and we're going to hear more about that tomorrow. To survive in an intemperate climate, manage our pluralism, and get along with Uncle Sam, we've had to develop a sense of humor that is self-deprecatory and mostly subtle. It remains a constant, and it's also one of our best exports. Think Lorne Michaels, Stan Aykroyd, Jim Carrey, Mike Myers, and Second City. I was going to add Pamela Lee Anderson, who is a Canadian, born, in fact, on Centennial Day, but that might not be considered by some funny, although she was the best-known person in the world a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, when the New Republic held a contest for the most boring headline, we won with another earnest new Canadian initiative. It is perhaps, when asked to determine the Canadian equivalent of as American as apple pie, the winning entry was as Canadian as possible under the circumstances. Thank you.
Please come back, gentlemen. No, stay here, Colin. Please come back. Thank you very much. That's divertissant at the same time. A couple of words, Catholics, Catholicism and Quebec society, just for those who still think it's a priest-ridden country, part of a country. When I entered Collège Jean Brébeuf in the 60s, which was a Jesuit college, I had seven teachers who were Jesuits having the Roman collar and wearing the cassock. And when I got out of there 4.5 years later, three of them had married their secretaries. And in practice, it says a lot about what happened to an approach of séculaire in Quebec. Paradoxically, in Canada, people still celebrate Christmas, although and even though it's a Christian, it's a Christian fête. In the United States, you celebrate November, Thanksgiving Day, as something which is of extraordinary commonality for all American citizens. Paradoxically, in Canada, you celebrate Christmas, and everybody's out there celebrating, even though it's a religious fête. And it's not always seen as a religious fête. So there's something maybe, and I'll be quite radical before I go to questions to the panel. There's a certain pride in our innocuous way of looking at issue in Canada, whereas I think there's a huge pride in the United States as exerting its power. And Canadians, I think, paradoxically, pride themselves in being modest, maybe too much sometimes. I think that's pretty well reflected, actually, in some of your data. I would take the first 5 minutes for what are strictly questions, not comments, not opinions, but if you ask questions, yes, please, madam.
Yes, I have a question, and it would go to all of you.
If you're familiar with a 10-second elevator speech, what would be your 10-second elevator speech as to why we need Canada and why, I'm so sorry, Mr. Johnston, and why Canada needs the United States?
One, two.
Every country needs a hat? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. So silly. Never mind.
Sure. No? Okay.
No. We need a neighbor, and you need a friend.
Will I have a crack at it, Jack?
Well, I thought that was, you know, what is it? No man is an island or something like that. I just think that there are, from the economic side, obviously mutual need and mutual advantages for cooperation to the extent that there are security issues. Some are shared, and so goodwill is important there because one could see conflicts. So I start think of this question is, you know, I'm writing a book, I hope, one day called Can There Be Europe Without Europeans? And, you know, that's what they're trying to do right now, create Europe when there aren't really Europeans. And one of the reasons maybe that there isn't the kind of need or impulse or incentive for common institutions between Canada and the United States is because the history of war is not there, and the history of much more easy flow and communication, thanks to common language and other things, has been there. So, what was your question again? Why do we...
10 words. Question was about a 10-word answer.
10-word answer.
Richard?
No one with a PhD is capable of a 10-word answer. Why do you think we worked for 8 years?
Richard?
I think the real answers have to do with things like national security, foreign policy, and that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a reality about America as the global superpower, which... the existence of which is probably actually pretty important. But the throwaway answer would be something like, you know, we need a mirror to see ourselves. Trouble is often when Canadians look in the mirror, they don't see anything.
Okay, so I guess we'll go to... the questions are actually sources of debates. We're not in necessarily facts here. So we'll go on to the floor.
Hi, Don Rothblatt from IGS. I wondered if you discovered any major differences in terms of citizen participation, volunteerism. And we know from the work of some of you very distinguished, all of you distinguished scholars here, especially Professor Brady, I think did a book with some other colleagues a few years ago, suggesting that since there is a kind of suspicion of government, a lot of things that are in the public sector, say in Canada, might be pushed into the nonprofit sector in the U.S. I mean, there are a lot of other things in the book, and I don't pretend to know them all, but I wondered if those differences emerged in your research.
Maybe is the best person to address.
Well, I haven't looked at those data recently. It'd be very interesting to look at them and to find out. Richard, you may have looked at the more...
Well, there is no body of data of the quality of the civic volunteerism work. I mean, that's just a given. That's Henry's stuff, which is the standard. But to the extent that you can come up with comparables, you're probably not going to be surprised that there is kind of less depth of volunteerism in Canada than in the U.S. Some of this actually is a product of public policy, tax treatment of charitable donations, for example, that sort of thing. Some of it is a compositional property. I mean, one of the, you know, to Henry and me as, you know, former altar boys, one of the distressing findings in the civic volunteerism stuff is that Catholics are less voluntaristic than Protestants and others are, and we're talking about a country which, although it is largely post-Christian in terms of its sort of content of belief, is 45% to 50% post-Catholic. And when you look at differences within the Canadian landscape on questions that are as akin as we can get them to the ones that Henry's work includes, the pattern is there in Canada as well. So my hunch is that if you had exactly comparable questions, although I can't say that I've looked at exactly comparable questions, it's a less voluntaristic society. But some parts of Canada, like British Columbia, Vancouver, for example, is an intensely voluntaristic place. My oldest son booked off work for 2 weeks and was one of the Blue Jackets that, when John Furlong gave the concluding thing, you know, Blue Jackets won, Cypress Mountain nothing, he was one of the guys who was up there for 2 weeks, 14 hours a day, building moguls and laying, you know, so there are differences on the landscape, but I think summarily, I think this is a more voluntaristic place.
The church going is lower than Canada than in the United States, meaning that Canada looks a little more like France with respect to their attitudes towards religion. And religion is one of the sources of a lot of civic voluntarism. Right. On the other hand, Canada has a higher rate of unionization, and I don't know what it is, but I know
it's
it must be higher. Yeah, it's about 30%. We're at about 15% or so right now.
12.
Yeah. Something like that, a lot less. And that's another source of political participation and involvement. So presumably there's higher levels through that in Canada. But, of course, a lot of that gets channeled through the NDP, through a particular party.
Joe Clark, and then I'll come back to it.
Thank you. I should say I'm used to being second. I want to comment on something which I think is there and doesn't show up in the presentation. Both these societies began as European Christian nations migrating to an open society. And we're not that to any degree as much now. The Statistics Canada stats are quite interesting about both what they report and what they project. Mother tongue language, neither English nor French in Canada. In 2001, it was 17% of the total. They're projecting in 2017, depending on the various scenarios, either 21% or 25%, a quite significant drop. Nearly half of that non-French, non-English is South Asian or Chinese. The South Asians are growing, partly for reasons of fertility. So this is a phenomenon that is going to continue to change. In terms of religions, in 1991, 4% were non-Christian. In 2001, 6.3% were non-Christian. 2017, it will be between 9.2% and 11.2% who are non-Christian. The Muslim membership is going to increase by 145%. The Hindu by 92%. The Sikh by 72%. Now, what's interesting about these dramatic changes, I don't know the U.S. statistics, they're similar except the sources are different. I want to come back to that in a moment. But what is quite interesting about this is that these new populations are not yet represented with anything like equality in our society, in our elites. And that's partly because anyone familiar with immigrant or integration knows that the first priorities are on being at home in your neighborhood, making sure your kids are okay. Very much a low-profile role, which may, I say to the social scientists, may show up in the questionings, in the questioning that is asked by professional polling. What's interesting to me about the two countries is, first of all, we are both in that sense culturally, which is what this is about, different from what we were. And we are becoming more different with each passing year. But what is also interesting is that we are becoming more different from one another than we were before. The U.S. population sources are disproportionately Hispanic. The Canadian new populations are disproportionately Asian. For the moment, Chinese. Increasingly in the future, South Asian. Why doesn't that show up? Why should we believe? What is there something wrong with the statistics that show that immigrant and non-immigrant, whatever that is, populations are have similar similar attitudes? Do cultures mean nothing? Do cultures of origin mean nothing? If they mean something, what do they mean? And surely that's more important than some of the graphing, with all respect, that we saw here today.
Well, let me address that, because this is a topic that both Richard and I have studied in our different countries. First thing is that immigrants change over time. There are huge differences between first, second, and third generation immigrants, both in terms of how they behave, both in terms of their social structural achievements, and both in terms of how they relate to their home countries, their countries of origin and their home countries. If you want to just take specifically the Mexican immigrants to the United States, Sam Huntington, in his book published in 2004, said Mexican immigration is the biggest threat to American national identity. Why? Because these are non-Christian. They don't have an experience with democracy. They are clustered in the Southwest, and they are going to be a new Quebec type fifth column within the United States. That was his doomsday scenario. Well, we looked at this using some of these statistics and discovered that by the third generation, most Hispanic immigrants to the United States are monolingual in English, just as the Italian immigrants were, just as the Jewish immigrants were, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's some linguistic assimilation, and language, is, to me, is critical both for common communication and also for the ability to climb the socioeconomic ladder. So that seems to be nothing new as in terms of 19th or early 20th century. That's point one. Point two is in terms of feelings of loyalty and patriotism, what we find also is that second, third generation Mexican Americans express as much loyalty in terms of the kinds of measures that we threw up there are as patriotic, as strongly America's important to me as so-called European Americans or native-born Americans. So I think that the kind of notion that these differences somehow endure or are incompatible with some kind of common culture is just, I don't think, right. I do think that there is a retention of pride in one's original culture. And, you know, St. Patrick's Day is 2 days from now, so everyone's going to go out, wear green, and get drunk, if that means you're being Irish. But I think, you know, one of the things actually is, and this is where I think Huntington was wrong, is that culture is not static. It evolves. And, you know, I had a metaphor, you know, the idea of the melting pot had a lot of negative connotations among some immigrants because melting was viewed as cleansing. You wash off everything that you came. But I think, you know, you view the melting pot as blending, and so what's in the pot changes, and sort of that becomes part of the culture. Then one, going on too long, but there's one other point that you made, and that is the degree of representation and political participation and civic engagement. And I think you're right. The first thing you do when you get off the boat is not register to vote, you know, and say, oh my God, you know, I want to run for school body president. The other things are more important. And nonetheless, if you look at levels of registration and voting in the United States, I mean, the Hispanic community, it's been going up. Asian community, it was always very surprising that levels of participation were as low as they were given the socioeconomic attributes of those populations. But even there, there's variation between the Vietnamese, the Chinese, the Koreans, Filipino immigrants to the United States. And my guess is that all those indicators of participation will grow, both voluntaristic and in simple electoral participation. What I do think is the fundamental challenge that you pose, and I think both countries are responding to it, and there's some resistance, in some sense, from the old guard, is what can be the meaning of, what does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to be a Canadian in this different kind of, you know, multi-ethnic population? Ernest Gellner was one of the leading writers on nationalism, said a multi-ethnic nation is an oxymoron. Okay? But what he meant was that there had to be, you could have, in some sense, ethnic differences, but there had to be some common mode of communication and common glue for the society to work. So that's a challenge. I don't, you know, we don't have to agree with his pungent statement, but I think you brightly point out that's a challenge. But I'm personally looking at the data in the United States, turn to you, Richard, for Canada, don't see this as the country is breaking apart because of this.
Well, and I think the important thing is the extraordinary assimilation capability and capacity for both countries. This is not the Balkans. Identities don't persist over long, long periods of time and become problematic at some point. They seem to, in fact, become alloys. How about that for the melting pot? We get alloys, good, which are very powerful.
That's good.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.